You're listening to Industry Iowa, presented by CIRIS, the Center for Industrial Research and Service. Here's your host, Stephen Wilson.
Welcome back to another episode of Industry Iowa, the podcast powered by CIRIS, where we explore the people, partnerships, and practices moving Iowa industry forward. I'm your host, Stephen C. Wilson, and today we're diving into a topic that's changing how businesses think, work, and grow: intelligent automation. To help us unpack it all, I'm thrilled to be joined by Andrew Pfeiffer, founder of the Process Innovation Lab and one of the most insightful voices in this space. Andrew is an entrepreneurial, big-picture thinker with deep expertise in operational and process excellence. He spent years helping organizations reimagine what's possible by combining design thinking, automation, and strategic innovation. Whether it's driving cost-effective process improvements or designing scalable intelligent automation solutions, Andrew has a track record of creating real sustainable value. Today, we're going to explore what intelligent automation really is, why it's different from traditional IT or RPA, and how leaders can use it to fuel innovation and operational excellence without getting buried in complexity. So whether you're just starting to explore automation or looking to scale your efforts, this conversation is packed with insights you can use right away. So let's get into it. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be back. Really enjoyed last time we had a chance to talk about design thinking, and excited to really kind of dive into the other side of the coin, which is, you know, not just on the design side, but on the automation side.
Excellent. So along those lines, how do you define intelligent automation? And how is it different from the traditional approaches, IT or traditional IT, RPA?
Yeah. So that's a great question, and one that's it's evolved quite a bit over the past several years. Just a little background. So, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, you know, when RPA kind of came out, and that's not a new, that wasn't a new concept at the time. It just kind of finally hit. I could go into the background as to why, maybe sometime a little later. But you know, being on the process design side, you know, we're always, you know, you're always kind of evaluating ways to add value through automation and things like that. And you know, traditional IT is, you know, like people would build things, you know, they do requirements, all agile transformation, all the agile work that came on, which, you know, helped accelerate value, that kind of thing. And then RPA came along, and I got involved with RPA just from an analysis perspective, which is really more my background. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked for process technology modeling and management companies for a majority of my career, because I just love solving problems. You know, I love mapping out processes. That's always been sort of my, mm-hmm. you know, one of my main interests in my career. And so you're always kind of looking at, hey, how can we drive value more quickly, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I got involved from an analysis perspective, from like, all right, well, if we did this, would it add value? You know, what would be the ROI, that kind of thing, through some of the modeling tools that I was involved with. And then I joined a team, actually became the lead process and eventually senior manager of the analysis team on an intelligent automation team at Cox Enterprises. And that's where I really kind of like, you know, honed, really truly understood what this is. So to get to your question, what is it, right? So let me tell you what it is not RPA, right? You have to think of it as, it is a, I kind of like to describe, it is a, kind of like, it's like its own tech stack in a way, right? You have to think of it as an integrated set of capabilities that you leverage and in different combinations, depending on what the problem you're trying to solve, right? Okay. So, you know, I'm not going to go, you know, I will briefly touch on intelligent automation as a sort of like a an approach, and, you know, there's a business aspect to it, right? Like, yeah. What tools are you deploying, right? Who owns them, right? Do you have a centralized team? Do you have a program? How do you do discovery? How do you run your operations? You know, so, but that's sort of like above the line, right? That's sort of above the line, mm-hmm. from the business perspective. But then there's the technical aspects below it. And that's where it really becomes very interesting to me. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at it from there is the ability to define, like, what exactly are you automating to begin with, right? Because that always goes back to process,
right?
So what is the process that you're trying to create value within? But then there's the how you do it, right? So like I said, it's not RPA, it's an integrated set of capabilities. So you have to look at it from an analysis and discovery perspective, and you have to look at it from a user-centric automation perspective, and then you go deeper into things like case management, and then of course, and that's just the process side. Then there's the data side, and that's when you get into the analytics process automation. You get into AI, you get into chatbots, you get into true integration, that kind of thing. So there's a whole kind of like wrapper of different technologies that go into intelligent automation. So let me kind of break this down a little bit, right? RPA is a piece of that puzzle.
Okay.
Right. And, you know, that is just a technology that allows you to drive like just human-centered data integration, right? That I find it kind of ironic because having gone deep down into this stuff, like to me, RPA was anything but intelligent, right? It was like clear business rules, right? Very, very sort of static actions, right? The less variation, the better. And that's where kind of so to me, RPA was always kind of like a misnomer. It's very robotic, so there's not a lot of intelligence in it. It's procedural automation, not process automation. So you know. When you know too much, sometimes you're like, okay, I can bash this a little bit. But that's one piece, right? And then you get into things like ingestion around like intelligent data, intelligent document processing, right? That's one of those pieces of the puzzle, right? So you got to think of it in terms of a puzzle. Then there's, you know, intelligent document processing, which, you know, I've seen some amazing like tools that can like look at like a handwritten receipt from like 1895 and completely generate the data out of it that you need. Like there's some really powerful, like no one should ever be rekeying things ever again, right? Like from an input perspective, those tools are, you know, table stakes now, right? Then you get into things like case management, right? And these are your more traditional, like big BPM systems. You know, you think of your Appians and your Pegas and your, and some of those other types of tools, right? More enterprise grade, like case management. Right. So that is, you know, but there's even more to it, right? So that's sort of like the boundary of, you know, where process is automated, right? But then you got to go up a step and be like, well, how do I know what to automate? How do I know where the problems are? And then you get into some more of the analytical tools that are still part of the tech stack, right? So you have your traditional process modeling tools, right? You can still put stuff on paper on the wall and all that kind of stuff. But there are tools out there that help you facilitate. I mean, we've all done, you know, in our remote world, we've all done process modeling sessions where everyone's, you know, remote and we're all drawing on tools, that kind of thing. That stuff still exists. And you still need that from a human collaboration, dialogue, right? Consensus building. But you still need people to kind of think through some of those things.
Yeah.
But there are ways that you can start to extract process related data in order to target the right things. And again, this is still part of your tech stack. So I'm talking about things like process mining, right? Which for those of you who aren't familiar with process mining, it is essentially going into your core databases, your core OSSs, like operational support systems. These are your ERPs, your financial, your CRMs, your marketing automation, all those different types of tools, you know, looking at your web traffic. And then leveraging the event logs of who pushed what button when, right, to change the state of something and performed an activity in one of those systems. Well, all that stuff is logged, right? So process mining takes that data and then sort of recreates what the process is visually, right? Okay. So these are your Solonises, right? Your your Appians, your iPaaS, all these, you know. The process mining industry went under a lot of consolidation, and a lot of those tools got bought. Even Microsoft bought a process mining tool, Mynit, several years ago. Anyway, so there's a lot of consolidation there. But think about that. Think about, you can just go into the core systems, get the event logs and then about who did what when, and basically re-engineer your process. Well, this is how it actually works. There's no system doesn't lie, right? So that's what actually happened. So you're able to perform three types of analysis around that, right? You can, how is it performing, right? What's the cycle time? Like all that timestamp stuff, that's all just given to you from just gathering the event log. Now, there's some work to be done around refining all that stuff and making sure you got the right data and all that. I'm not going to go into those details, but I'm just talking capability here. So there's a performance question. There's a what they call a conformance. So is anything happened that shouldn't be? Huh, we have an invoice that was paid that there was never a purchase order approved. And my favorite line response to that has always been, well, that can't happen. Sure. Yeah, well it happened 20 times in the past 6 months. So obviously it can. The question is why? So that's conformance, right? Is there anything that's not a non-compliance, right? I'm sorry, that's compliance. Conformance is there a standard process that should be followed that is not, right? So that's conformance. Sorry, I always get those two backwards, compliance and conformance. So switch your head around on those two, all right? So that's just one analysis level. That's a system level based, right? Then there's task mining, right? Which is actually like being able to understand what the humans are doing within different systems in order to cobble together a process and extract that same data to then look at it. So all that feeds into, okay, where are the process problems? Where's the rework? Where are things happening that shouldn't be happening? You know, where are the errors introduced? Blah, 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 right? Which is grist for the operational excellence mill, as far as I'm concerned, right? But, you know, as operational excellence leaders, right, we really need to take a look, be like, why are we spending all of our own time, like, and taking months to gather data when many of that data is accessible in very short studies. So we need to look at ourselves. How can we accelerate our own processes, right? So that's looking at it from a process mining, task mining, right? And there's even sort of like video-based task mining, right? When people don't do things in systems, when you can't track anything. That's an evolving area that's still, I think, has a lot of potential. So what are people doing physically that can't be captured in a system that could potentially be evaluated to see if we can't improve safety, right? If we can't improve quality, if we can't reduce ergonomic issues. There's a lot of potential there as well.
Along those lines.
So lots to unpack there, right? So including things like simulation and digital twins, like there's like now we're getting more into the intelligent part of things. So anyway, so all of that makes up the various pieces of the stack. And it depends on what the problem you're trying to solve. Is it an invoicing input? You know, are you trying to improve quality on the input? Are you trying to figure out where the bottleneck? Like there's all kinds of questions we can answer. And we have a lot of tools. And then a lot of the tools now in terms of their capabilities, they're all building in Gen AI. So as an analyst, you just tell it what you want to do, how you want it to automate, right? So the whole idea of agentic AI, which is that whole new buzzword that people have, right? You're really giving something agency, right? Which is the ability to change the state of things within systems without human oversight, which should, scare the crap out of everybody. But at the same time, there's a lot of potential power there, but there's rules. It's not as simple as it sounds. Anyway, that was a long-winded answer, but it is actually a very complicated question that people, in my opinion, don't really understand. And they have to look at it more holistically from a business and technical, both from a process and tools perspective and a data perspective and things like that. Okay. That's all.
And that's a wrap. That's the show. Thank you, Andrew, for being a guest on Industry Iowa. Along that line, you talked a little bit about it, the business case for intelligent automation. Why now more so than any other time?
Right.
Is it important? Is it relevant? Does it need to be embraced and better understood?
Yeah. It absolutely does. Right. Because at the end of the day, right, as our friend Joe Paris likes to say, right, time is the enemy. Yep. Right. So I brought up originally that, You know, intelligent automation is a set of capabilities, tools and capabilities that is like a stack of things, right? But is then, so then you need to put the lens on it of, so, you know, that's, those are the what I use, but then it's the how. Like, what is my approach? What is my methodology? And the tools are so powerful today in terms of your ability to prototype and get things visual and get feedback on them, right? I mean, you're talking weeks, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the traditional IT model is, even if you're using Agile, right? You don't just be like, you know, hey, I think I'm going to write an ERP today. That's not a thing, right? So, right. So you have to go through this process of evaluating things, you know, understanding the change impact, right? Doing the change management plans. You've got to like understand the business and the requirements, and you have to, you know, start implementing those in tools. And you still do that in Agile fashion, but that takes a long time, right? What if, right, you could have maybe a couple strategy workshops, settle on some hypotheses, right? Under, you know, clarify, okay, this hypothesis is based on some assumptions. What is the minimum amount of things we need to answer in order to know if this hypothesis is correct or not, right? Mm-hmm. And can we leverage intelligent tools to bring that to life in a way that we know if we need to pivot or persevere, right? Now, a lot of this came out of the idea of like building an app for the market. Can I pivot or persevere quickly? That kind of thing. Yeah. I think those things are still, that mindset is incredibly valuable and still develop, still, there's still kind of like this gap between, you know, the experimenters and the rapid delivery people and sort of like operations and operational excellence, you know, and my mission is kind of continue to like, you know, further merge those two disciplines into a single kind of unified fire. So getting back to you, what's the business value, right? So it's about time, right? It's about not doing things quickly that don't work, right? Figuring that out fast and settling on the things that are actually going to drive real true value based on, you know, really engaging and understanding, you know, what the problems really are, who's having them, why, where's the friction in the business, all that kind of thing. So it's really about time. You know, you don't have 2 years to implement a new ERP anymore, right? Yeah. It's like you got to adopt and go, or, you know, in my opinion, you know, you can wrapper some of these pretty powerful process automation tools around case management or other types of, you know, intelligent case management or other BPMSs around some of your core systems, right? Because you got to, like, you know, because they're sources of data, but they also have their own interfaces. But those interfaces are meant for humans, mm-hmm. right? And it's all, you know, in lowering that threshold of where the action takes place or down deep into the systems under a layer of you know, sort of process orchestration is really, really useful. I'm sorry. Did that answer your question? I love this stuff so much. I'm like, oh God, there's so many points I want to make, right? So I gotta make. Did I answer your question?
yes, it did. It did indeed. So you mentioned also, you know, operational excellence, and we you know, again, that understanding that operational excellence is something that the organization needs to strive for, right? It's not a department, so to speak, there.
Right. It's a state of readiness.
It's a state of readiness. JP, I expect a dollar every time I say, yeah, right? State of readiness.
Or maybe he expects a dollar.
He does. Yeah, there we go. I bet he does. So how does intelligent automation then support these broader operational excellence initiatives?
That's a fantastic question, and I think this is obvious. So one of my favorite statements is stating the obvious with a sense of discovery.
Stating the obvious with a sense of discovery,
right?
Oh, okay, all right.
Here's what I think is obvious, right? But I'm going to say what this is. Like every process has automation in it now, right? Like everything is tracked. everything goes through a system. You cannot do process improvement anymore without IT in the room, because everything has some kind of, someone bought a tool that they're using as part of their process, right? That, you know, helps them digitize, track, whatever, right? So anytime you want to do process improvement, you can't not do it without understanding the impacts to your systems, because your systems are your business now, right? Like your IT operations are your business. You can't digitize, go through a digital transformation without having digitized things and put it in the system somewhere.
Right.
So that's my point about, your question about how does this support operational excellence? Like the two are not different anymore, right? Mm-hmm. As operational excellence practitioners, like we need to understand how to quickly deploy technology from an intelligent automation perspective in order to, drive value and time to market for the business. We cannot spend 6 months doing a Six Sigma project, right? That is just, you created value, but you missed 5 months of being in the market, right? So time to market is so critical. So how does this relate to operational excellence? One, the tools allow you to see into the true process. So you can do your performance, you can do your conformance, you can do your compliance, right? All the things that we think about constantly in terms of operational excellence, right? These, your value chains, your value streams go across departments, right? But the triggers in one system impact triggers in another. And if you don't have that holistic view, right, you need all those silos at the table in order to truly understand and automate things from a value stream perspective, right? You have to have your stakeholder. But here's the thing that I think is most powerful, right? If you combine a couple strategic workshops, right, to say, okay, what do we really need to do? And you know, you and I have kind of talked about like the entrepreneurial operating system, stuff like that, where you do some workshops around, rocks and, and accountability and those types of things. Like, imagine if you had someone in the back of the room understanding what you're deciding in this conversation. And, one of your key initiatives that you describe, right, they're listening. And so you do that week one. And then week two, you get that person who is listening in from IT in the background, and you get a couple subject matter experts in a room, and you kind of hash out, okay, here's the very thing we need to prototype. We need to understand what kind of impact. And I mean, it could be as like, looking at a hospital checkout process. It could be the pick, pack, and ship process. It could be, whatever your business is, right? The intake of customer forms or patient forms when they come in the door. It could be any process, right? You sit down in a room for a week and you hash out, okay, here's exactly how we'll know if this works. We're going to test it at the end of the week. And then we're going to know by the end of, and they build it while you're doing that work. So you come out at the end, it's something that actually is working.
Yeah.
That is a live app that then you can be like, well, the user says this is actually going to make their life harder. Goodbye. All right. Next iteration. Okay. By the end of the next week, you have the next one tested. So within like 3 or 4 weeks, you should, unless you completely misunderstand your users, your customers, right, your stakeholders, by iteration 2 or 3, you better have probably nailed something that's actually going to move the needle for the business, right? Yeah. Some hypothesis that you validated, right? Otherwise, you got more serious problems. But that would still be feedback, right? So then you settle on something that you know is going to move the needle. Maybe you simplify an app. Maybe you make it easier to use. Maybe you streamline the flow for the people. Like you lean it out, like whatever. But then you put the tools in place to digitize it. And then you're just in a series of sprints that IT knows how to do, right? Think about that. You took maybe like 6-9 months of discussions and, negotiating and, going through procurement and, by then the business has changed, right?
Right.
So, time is the enemy. You have to shorten down and make decisions in such small increments now that I think it's kind of unavoidable. Like this is now state of the art. But think about it. Like we had a strategy session. We came up with some hypotheses. We tested a couple of them. We built them live. They were working applications, working whatever. And then you're off to release it, right? Mm-hmm. People are starting to use it more and more and gathering feedback. Like that's the state of the art, right? Now, you know, in my work, right, I usually draw that out to 3 weeks where, you know, we do a formal, you know, we do some strategy work. We do what's called a design sprint for a week, answer some hypotheses. And then the next week, right, is when you actually like do the actual building. Like you test it, you validate it. So now you're going to start building it and making it real, that kind of thing. So maybe you do some rough and ready prototypes with some like drawings and things like that, which is good enough to get feedback. Right.
Yeah.
So that's more of a three week sprint around it. You know, but you know, Tim, like I've had conversations with folks and it was like, well, why do you need that third week? Just build it alive, something working live. Cause you can, right. You can go into tools like Replit and Manus Lovable and be like, okay. And just be like, okay, here's the app I want to build. Right. And just like prompt engineer it. Right. The whole vibe coding thing. It's crazy. I mean, it's just so crazy. And it's a question of mindset and a respect for the value of time.
Yeah.
Right.
You're
that will lead you eventually to the path of going down this path of using the tools, gathering the data that you can, studying, doing very short studies of how things really work. And then reacting and addressing those in almost in real time through methodologies like design thinking and design sprints.
Right, and that's what I was gonna prototype, lean into
rapid
there,
prototyping in automation
tools. Design thinking, right? That's what you've been talking about there.
Yes, that's what we talked about last time, right? Design thinking. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it very briefly, how does design thinking then play into the success of this? You've talked about it. You've talked about the sprints and the iteration. Yeah. And can you just, for somebody that maybe didn't catch the other podcast and doesn't quite understand design thinking,
right.
What role does it play?
Sure. Quickly reframe that. Right. So, you know, design thinking has been for the past 15 years has been very much a sort of like, it's called design thinking, but some people call it like human-centered design. It's all about, you know, what I like to call observing humans in their natural habitat.
Okay.
Right. And
I just pictured, I just heard David Attenborough in my ear.
Right.
Giving some narration. Right. Some narration over the top of that. Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yet again, laboring through a spreadsheet, right? I mean, oh my God. All right. So, design thinking is really, at its core, is about going down an empathetic pathway to truly understand and derive and expose real humans' needs and unmet needs, right? And, you know, there's different people have it, like you can talk about the Kanno model and strategic deployment and the X, you know, Hoshin-Kanri, all that kind of stuff. Like a lot of jargon, a lot of like big, scary, incomprehensible models. This is really just about can I get in someone's head, in their shoes, in their mindset, in their day-to-day to uncover the insights I need to make the process better, to make their experience better. Again, a lot of this came out of the, like, you know, building apps for market, but the principles still apply. Like, you know, how many process improvement sessions have you been in where there aren't any people who do the process, right? People who know that people do the process. Like, so you're still, it's like this level of abstraction, right? Behavior is always the highest quality information, right? Observe behavior. So really, and that's all, and I would say to some design thinking practitioners, like, miss that step sometimes, like truly doing the research, user research, all that kind of stuff. But then it's really about uncovering the insights, the what works, what doesn't work, what could work, And then building, you know, a series of questions around how might we address this, you know, how might we make this better? You know, here are some tools we could use. Here's pieces that we could address with them, right? And then coming up with some, that's where the whole ideation takes place. And this, you can do this in a week, right? Okay, well, what's the big idea? How would that work? Let's prototype it and then like walk people through it, like a test out loud, you know, out loud testing. Like, okay, here's a bunch of pieces of paper. What do you think you should do? Kind of rough and ready prototyping, right? In order to adjust. So, you know, design thinking and intelligent automation, given the power of these tools, are just like natural, you know, partners in terms of your thinking about how to solve problems and how quickly they can be solved. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're trying to get down to, you know, what are the core questions we need to answer? Like, you know, you get into these big projects and then you just forget who it impacts. You forget what the business value is. You're just trying to meet the next deadline and, you know, miss the next project management status report. And like, what are we even doing this for anymore, right? Does anybody even still remember why we started doing it? Everyone's just focused on the next sprint, right? So, design thinking is a mindset of experimentation and curiosity, but it's wrapped in some pretty, really well-traveled paths of methods and techniques and models that you would build in facilitated sessions and things like that. So yeah. It's essential to intelligent automation. Like you have to get in, like, as you're automating processes, people perform probably, like, you can't separate the two in my mind.
You mentioned mindset. For leaders just starting out, what's the best first step or mindset shift that they have to embrace?
Yeah. Experimentation. Uh-huh. Right. Like, okay. I heard a great analogy maybe a year or so ago. And it wasn't necessarily around intelligent automation. It was more just like... It was like Harvard Business Review. It was, but like, you don't take enough risks, right? And you don't look at your projects as a risk portfolio, right? And and the analogy that they used was, if every venture or venture capital or private equity company, right, was like everything we invest in has to be a sure bet, they would never invest in anything, right? Like, it's not the point. The point is that you get one unicorn out of 50 failures.
Yeah.
Right. So, because that one unicorn is, you know, pays for all those 50 and then a lot more. And I really think that a lot of people just don't have that mindset as executives. We're so risk averse, right? We don't want to do anything wrong.
Right. Right.
And that's a really hard mindset. But if you change your thinking of, okay, We're still going to maintain control by making sure that people are answering some fundamental questions in these experiments of, okay, why would this even matter, mm-hmm. right? Like, who would this serve? Like, what question needs to be answered in order to know this is worthwhile continuing to pursue, right? If you can take that perspective of every project is a risk, and I manage my risk by ensuring smart questions, I can still do things really quickly, mm-hmm. right? And get to answers more quickly, rather than let's stress this out and have a conversation for 6 months about what we should do and who's got the budget and blah, blah, blah. Like you don't have that kind of time anymore. You just don't. Like, mm-hmm. Your lunch is going to get eaten by somebody eventually who's not being so risk averse. And I find it actually funny. Maybe this is a bit of an aside. You know, while I'm on a soapbox here, I think people really need to ask themselves how much of how processes have been standardized is really just about reducing risks that used to happen. Like, we've mm-hmm. changed the process right. to, you know, account for something that happened twice.
Right. But, yeah.
Like so many processes have become burdened with, you know, all this noise that doesn't, like, because something happened a while ago. Like, this is how policies just develop and develop and develop. Like, because something happens. Oh, we got to update the policy, and now we have to spend all this time trying to enforce it. Blah 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 blah. Right? Just put some guardrails around. Like,
right. So we take it,
thin it out. It's just crazy to me.
In Six Sigma language, we talk about it where we've got a special cause, but we treat it as though it's a common cause, as though it's happening. It's within the system. You know, no, it's a special.
Yeah.
Cause I'll use this analogy. And when I'm doing some classes thereof, if I move around and I bump a table and it spills over, you know, somebody's glass of water that's on the table.
Yeah.
I'm not going to follow the Domaic method where I'm going to, okay, let's properly define what the method is, you know, what the issue is. Yeah. Let's put a team together. Let's analyze for root cause, you know, all of these things. Right. No, I'm going to identify what caused it. And then, as you say, put some guardrails around it so that it doesn't happen again.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. I'm going to adjust. And I think what you're talking about there is risk averse. Are you maybe alluding to the fact that we've done that so much with processes? It seems to have infiltrated our just the way that we take action and where we make a decision, as you say, not taking those risks that we as leaders should be taking.
Yeah. Yeah, we've just internalized, you know, not taking risks and thinking of, you know, like every project I've ever worked on is like, what's the ROI? What's the ROI? What's the ROI? Right? Be like, well, is there like a, and look, I'm not saying those things aren't important in some level, but it's a question of can you, if you're going to spend 6 months doing something, right? And how much time is wasted, right? And just, it's not really, if you can run 10 experiments and one of them works in that same time frame, you've now tried 9 things that didn't work that you weren't going to spend 9 months figuring that 6 months figuring that out, right? It's just, you know. Anyway, so I'm sorry. This is about intelligent automation, right? which is, you know, and I kind of went down the design thinking path, but I just think they're so interrelated because every process has automation in it now, right? You can't avoid it, right? But it's just, you know, the tools are just gotten so accessible, right? That as process, like we cannot be process designers without also being process automation mindful. Right. It's just not.
So what makes a the one of the final questions here as we read, what makes a good automation candidate then? If somebody's out there going, are they saying, geez, am I ready for to move into this? Am I ready to embrace this? Am I ready to pursue this? What makes a good automation candidate?
So you kind of go down some basic discovery, right? Which is, you know, where do you have a lot of invisibility, right? Like you don't really have good visibility into what's going on. You know, there's not a lot of good quality. Maybe you just know that you have too many people doing too many manual things, right? There's too many spreadsheets, you know, and then again, that's from more of like a subjective perspective, right? But then you have to have, you know, insightful process designers who are like, okay, I'm not doing anything unless I get the data out of the systems to tell me what's going on, right? That's always step one, right? Who are the users, like, you know, in terms of like, we're going to deep dive into something, right? Mm-hmm. What does the data tell us about how the process is performing now? Like, where do we have compliance and conformance issues, right? Mm-hmm. Performance, compliance, conformance. You know, where can I do some user studies to get deep into, you know, what's really going on with the users, are the stakeholders, right? It could be customers, right? When I was saying, you could be customers, right? I use that user generically. Users of your business as a service, right? Are your customers, are your vendors, right? Are you hard to do business with? You know, and just, you know, pick something that you know is a problem, right? You know, have a mindset of experimentation, right? And, you know, go hire some folks who can help you, right? So when it comes to hiring this is actually your article that you wrote because you quoted me, right?
Yes.
You hire a consultant for clarity, capability, and capacity.
Right, exactly.
This is about clarity, right? Like, okay, yeah. How do I even do that? I don't even know what I would need to do this, right? Yeah. And then it's like, well, I need someone to that. Okay, now I know what I need to do. Now I need the capability to do it. So help me build that capability, right? There's people out there like me who can help show you that roadmap, right?
Yeah.
And then pick a few tools, right? Don't overthink it and stand some of this stuff up, right? There are freemium versions of some of these tools like Celonis and Mindy and some of these other ones. You know, Microsoft has bought Minit, so they have some process mining tools for Dynamics or SAP or Oracle or, you know, Salesforce. Like, you know, go and start, you know, thinking in these terms, right? Like, I have data that I can leverage from a process perspective. I have tools that I can rapidly deploy, right, through that are all, you know, drag and drop types of things, right? I mean, I even saw, and this isn't a plug for a particular vendor, right, but the platform, the company Appian, right, someone wrote it a prompt that says, I want to create, because the sale, like a UI design standard of Appian is published, right? Well, when something's published, you can ChatGPT it to use mm-hmm. to make it a verb. So they created a prompt that says, I want to create a UI with these fields, with this data and these rules in the sale, quote unquote, standard of Appian, you know, create me the code that I can just copy and paste into Appian's, you know, designer. And it was like done. And then it was just drag and drop into the field, stuff like that. Like literally in a prompt, you can create an app, right? And one of the videos that Appian actually has, and this is one of my refrains that I use now, is like, we can build an app in a day, right? Now that's a little, like, you have to get good at Appian or any of these tools in order to do that. But the capability's there.
Right?
If you have, if you know how to leverage it. Right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so to kind of put a bow on that, right? If you truly want to be like, the traditional way of doing this isn't working. It's taking too long. We get into these sprints and we lose direction, blah, 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 right? You're not doing enough experiments. You're not putting things in front of people in a weekly, you know, 2-week basis that gives you insight into whether things are going to work or not, right? You know, and even in, you know, agile shops, right? You still get this drift away from, you know, and it was originally meant to not drift, like get closer to the users.
Right.
And then of course, we put processes and tools and frameworks around something when there's like people over process and tools, right?
Mm-hmm.
in the Agile Manifesto, which I always find entertaining. But anyway,
there's
a lot of pieces there, right? It's a technology issue. It's a mindset issue. It's a methods and approach, issue. So there's a lot of pieces that go into intelligent automation, right? And we didn't get into the whole AI thing, and you know that's a whole. Right. That's a whole, like the intelligent part of automation, right? So
if somebody wants to find out, wants to connect with you, what's the best way to do it? Find out a little bit more about what you do, how you do.
So go out to my website. You know, it's right now it's still very much a work in progress, right? But it's just the process innovation lab, oneword.com. So you can also find me on LinkedIn, C.Andrew Pfeiffer. My first name's Carl, but I go by my middle name. So you'll find me under C.Andrew Pfeiffer at the process, or Andrew at the processinnovationlab.com.
All right. Well, Andrew, thanks so much for being on Industry Iowa.
No, you're very welcome, Steve. thank you for inviting me back. I hope this has been useful to your listeners. This is a whole fascinating field. And, you know, like I said, I've spent my career on both the design and the automation side. And to me, I'm like, well, I'm just a process improvement guy now, right?
Yeah.
There is no coin anymore to have two sides to. It's all part of improvement now.
Absolutely. Thanks again, sir.
You bet, Steve.
Thank you again for being a guest on Industry Iowa.
Thank you so much. It was great to be with you.